TFM.
This is J.G. Hertz, the General Martok on Deep Space Nine, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome, Niners, to another episode of The Orb, our dedicated Deep Space Nine podcast. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me, as he always is my esteemed co-host, Matthew Rushing. And Matthew, I have to say, I think your clone is coming along quite nicely. I was just in there peeking at it in the bath.
You weren't supposed to look yet. He's not finished.
Thank goodness, because otherwise I might get arrested by Odo for peeking into the bath.
Yeah, he still looks a little bit like a sea monkey. So, you know, let it percolate. Get a little cuter.
Get a little cuter. Oh, the cute clone. That's definitely not an appropriate title for the episode we're going to discuss, The Cute Clone.
That's a reference to the movie Juno. So if anybody ever saw that's something that she mentions in that film. So yeah, anyway.
All right. Yes, everyone. Today we're going to be continuing our 30th anniversary rewatch of Deep Space Nine with the third episode of Season 1, A Man Alone. Of course, as we discussed last time, Matthew, this is the third episode to air, but the second to be produced. And here is a quick synopsis. When a man is murdered aboard this station, Odo becomes the prime suspect. Kira is certain he couldn't have done it, but Sisko is not so sure. Odo sees that he is being framed, but convincing his new crewmates and unraveling the mystery won't be easy. The only more difficult task might be Julian getting Dax to go out to dinner with him. So that sums up two of the three plots in this episode, Matthew, which we'll talk about along the way. But why don't we just start out with the Julian and Jadzia flirtation moment, because I'm sure you have something to say about that.
Yeah, this is an interesting part of the story, and obviously it's something that a lot of people these days tend to get frustrated with. But, you know, one of the things that I really responded to in the episode was the way in which they build the character of Dax here. And, you know, they're trying to walk this tightrope of having her be this beautiful 28-year-old woman who also has the experience of hundreds of years of lifetime. And what that does to a person. And I think what I was fascinated in the episode was the way in which Terry actually walks the line playing Jadzia of not reacting the way a human would to this pursuance by Dr. Bashir, where many, I think, humans would find this kind of obnoxious and annoying. For the most part, and there's a little bit of that where she herself is almost struggling with the side of her that can see him as being somebody who's very young, who doesn't, you know, and seeing him for who he is, which is a person who has a very short lifespan and, you know, is very eager, all those kind of things, being the side of her that might be maybe slightly annoyed, but also the part of her then that's also flattered, the 28-year-old who's being pursued, you know. So there's all these conflicting emotions that are going on there with Dax, which I find that so interesting. And I think that's one of the things that really gets kind of played out throughout this series, especially in this relationship, which, again, I know a lot of people like to kind of complain about, but I think what it shows is, and it gives us a real insight into Trills, specifically in the way in which they deal with beings who are much younger than they are.
Mm-hmm.
Trills have a completely different understanding of time and a different understanding of perspective than because of that. And I think this is what allows Dax to be able to handle this situation completely differently than a normal being would, who only has, say, maybe 80 to 100 years of life. Mm-hmm. She has a much larger perspective. As Obi-Wan would say, you know, she has a much larger view of the world and the universe. And therefore, it creates a much more interesting situation because it's one that can then evolve for both of the characters as we move forward. Because you also see Dax here struggling with the idea that, you know, for most Trills, they kind of look at relationships differently, she mm-hmm. says here. But that's something that kind of changes over time with Dax. I think she gets much more comfortable with just being in her own skin and kind of being her, you
right.
know? And so I think, again, all of these things create arcs for all of the characters involved. And I think that that's really, really interesting. So
yeah. Well, this is fairly new to her being joined at this point. So she's growing accustomed to it. I have to go back and look for the details of like exactly how many years, because we get the flashback in Emissary of when the Dax Symbian is transferred from mm-hmm. Curzon to her. But
I don't think it's been that long.
It hasn't been that long. Yeah. So she's still becoming comfortable in her own skin, being joined at this point. And so, yeah, the point you make there about, you know, she's the 28-year-old woman who may be flattered that Julian is interested in her, but at the same time, she's the 328-year-old joined Trill symbiont who is maybe viewing Julian as like this noisy little kid and kind of amusing, I think, which I kind of get that feeling from the scene when she has him try the game himself. Like, she knows yes. exactly what's going to happen, and so it's kind of amusing to her.
Well, and I like that you said that. Like, this is amusing to her because of her perspective.
Right, yeah. And the fact that the episode opens with that scene, it's one of the things that I think you can recognize that this is the next episode after Emissary in terms of production. Because you had Julian pursuing Jadzia as soon as she arrives at the station. You know, he's very interested mm-hmm. in her. And that continues right at the beginning of this episode. And yeah. that feels like that kind of direct connection to me that links them in terms of the production order.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The next thing we can talk about, Odo and Quark, I called it Alien Perspectives. Because it stands out to me that you and I are on Warp 5, we're doing our rewatch of Enterprise 20th Anniversary mm-hmm. rewatch. And we often talk about how on the NX-01, you have T'Pol and Phlox, the only two aliens on the ship. And sometimes they get together and they talk. Usually it's over a meal, but they comment on the humans and they give this other perspective. And mm-hmm. I got a little bit of right. that feeling here. Of course, this was produced long before Enterprise, but it's almost like this is a little bit of an inspiration of that, where you have Quark and Odo, and they're watching the O'Briens up there, and Odo says, "I'll never understand the humanoid need to couple," and then Quark says, "You never coupled," and Odo says, "Choose not to, too many compromises," and then he goes right. into something that will be quite familiar to those of us who have been married, and what relationships are like. But it's just the discussion between the two of them, the sort of observation of people who are outsiders for them, in this case, Miles and Keiko both being human. And the other thing that it does that I love is that it gives us, it establishes the fact that these two characters, Quark and Odo, have this long relationship history together that predates what we're watching with the arrival of the Federation, and instantly gives us this important background and adds depth to their characters.
No, I really agree with that. I think it's one of the things to which obviously makes, you know, Star Trek always so interesting is when you have these alien characters who are then able to speak into human existence by commenting on the things to which they find odd, to which we find normal, right? And I love the fact of you know, Odo giving a piece of himself here to Quark, which is so interesting because you wouldn't think that they would have this type of relationship where they would kind of share these very personal details with each other. And yet they're just sitting there talking, and he can't quite understand this idea of, like you said, coupling. And I think what makes this actually really brilliant is that this is setting up in this third episode something to which is going to be absolutely paramount to the character of Odo moving forward. You know, obviously, as we're watching this in order, we don't realize that. Mm-hmm. But that's exactly what's going to happen. And I think that's what makes this actually pretty beautiful, is that's the case, is that they are putting a, they are weaving a thread here for this character to which we're going to continue to pull on for the entire series. And then we already know a little bit about Ferengi from TNG, but what's interesting here is to watch Quark not really talk about himself or the way in which he views relationships. He's just more interested in then kind of pulling out from Odo in this conversation, mm-hmm. what he can find out about this character, which he thinks might help him later on.
Well, and he's also a bartender, we already know, so he's playing that role of,
yep,
yeah, listening.
100%, yes. Yeah, no, really, really well put there. And so I think that's what makes this very interesting, is to watch that relationship and the ways in which, you know, for all of Odo's powers of, you know, deduction and ability to be mysterious, well, you know, Quark is able to pull out of him information that he might not readily give up if he was actually really kind of thinking about it. And so, again, we see Quark's powers, like you said, is being the bartender. And I think that's great. And so, no, this whole thing is really wonderfully played, and it juxtaposes then, you know, us with another really important distinction between TNG and Deep Space Nine, which is these characters, O'Brien and Keiko, which we've known so long, we're actually going to dig into their marriage here.
Yeah.
And it is like legitimately one of the most real type conversations that real married people go through. Like, so many married people have moved because of one of the couple's jobs.
Yeah.
And then the other feels a little bit lost and not sure what they're going to do. And it leaves them in a place that they're not comfortable, and it brings up these type of discussions. So just really good, excellent writing here on all fronts.
Well, and what's happening to the O'Briens is something that I see often living in Japan, because and with things I deal with, the people I deal with related to my work, who are very often expats, business people. It's not always the case, but more often than not, the case that the husband in the marriage gets transferred to Tokyo and the wife comes along with them. And then they've had to leave their career, put their career on hold, move over here, and they're in a foreign land where everything is unfamiliar, just like it is for Keiko here, where they're moving to Bajor. And not only has she had to leave the Enterprise, leave her career and all, but she's really like a fish out of water at this point. It's not like they transferred to another starship where she's still within the same system, you know, as before. So that's something that's quite familiar to me. after this, we move on to a conversation with Sisko and Jadzia, which I also love for the same reason that I love the Ode to Corquan, which is that the writers are showering us with background information about characters in these little bite-sized moments. It's just an exchange between Benjamin and Jadzia about Asna and Steamed Asna, which I say would be a great name for a band. But they're just talking about this very meaningless thing, which transitioned to them reminiscing about the past. But we learn so much about their long relationship in so few words. And it also made me think, you remember when writers used to actually tell you about the characters? And you got to know the characters? And we're only in the third episode of the series, the second one written, and I already feel like I'm starting to know Quark and Odo and Benjamin and Jadzia and the history of Dax in just this short time.
No, I this is all throughout this episode of being able to get little bits and pieces of the characters from these conversations. And like you said, you're learning all about the relationship between Dax and Sisko, but you're also learning about Sisko's background, the fact that his father was a chef, and used his kids as guinea pigs. And, you know, it's just a really wonderful conversation in it. And also the ease with which they have this conversation because, you know, Jadzia is trying to bring up to him, hey, you know, we don't have to be friends if this is too difficult for you. And the beauty is that he just shrugs that off. Of course they're going to stay friends. And he does that by just reminding her of their relationship and the depth of it and all the things they've been through. To him, that is not something that is ever going to go away or that he would want to go away. And so I think there's a real beauty in that. And like you said, I mean, this episode is just kind of rife with all of these little details that we find out about characters that helps you understand some of our major players here in ways that many of the shows take years to do.
If they ever do it at all.
This is the third episode.
Yeah.
Well, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And this is episode three, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's insane. And as you've mentioned, this was the second one in production. So this is actually the second episode that they had produced. And therefore, that makes it even more interesting that there's so much about these characters that we're learning so quickly. And I think it again lets us know is that they want to cement these characters in our minds because it's almost as if the writers realize, you know, that one of the things that was really difficult on TNG for people was it wasn't the TOS crew, and it took that show a while to find its groove. And that meant it took a while for people to respond to the characters. Part of that had to do with the way the show was written, so that we weren't really learning anything about the characters, so you didn't have anything to gravitate towards. I feel like they're trying to fix that here with Deep Space Nine, which is to immediately, first few episodes, we're letting people know who these characters are. We're helping them understand who these characters are by these little conversations that feel so real and like natural.
Yeah.
That three episodes in, we feel like we know Sisko pretty well already. You know, we feel like we know Dax pretty well, and Bashir and Quark and Odo and Major Kira. So it's again a place where I think the writers intentionally, I would say, are really putting their stamp on, we want people to be able to feel connected to the show more quickly than they did, say, even The Next Generation.
Right. Well, and the setting of putting it in a stationary location, the fact that they're not on their way to solve some kind of crisis at the beginning of the episode gives you the time to be able to have these moments in the first place. And that, again, you remember, people complained about the setting How can it be Star Trek if they're not going somewhere on a ship? But the writers know that they can do a lot with that setting.
Yes.
And
yes,
really delve into the human condition. That's the whole really point of Star Trek, a core point of it anyway. And this, as we move forward through the episode, same thing. We're learning more about Odo when he talks to Sisko. We're learning, like, his view of justice. So he's head of security on the station, and we're accustomed to that meaning a certain thing in Star Trek. Federation security officers are supposed to be upholding the ideals of the Federation, but of course, Odo is not a Federation security officer, and he's an alien, one of a kind at this point. And so how is he viewing things? And he's transitioning from having worked for the Cardassians to now working for the Bajorans and supporting the Federation. And the line that always sticks out to me here is when Sisko tells him, "You're not going to take the law into your own hands." And Odo says, "The law, Commander Laws, change depending on who's making them. Cardassians one day, Federation the next, but justice is justice. And as long as I'm in charge of security," and then he trails off, and Sisko tells him, "If you can't work within the rules, I'll find someone who can." But we already were learning about Odo, that he has this, he's driven by his own definition of justice and is very willing to make up the rules himself to achieve justice as he sees it, which is very different from what we're accustomed to with the Star Trek show.
You know what I find most interesting about that conversation? And, you know, I really appreciate what Odo says, because in many ways it's so true. And I think we even just look through history, and the idea is that something can be lawful, but that doesn't actually make it right or just. And what's so fascinating is we as human beings, we have this innate sense of what is right and wrong and just, which I think what Odo's saying is there is a definitive article, justice, to which we all can kind of agree on. And he's saying there is a right and a wrong, and I believe that to be immutable, regardless of who's making quote-unquote the laws. So it's just a really interesting thing for somebody to say. And in many ways, it kind of comes down to the American idea of that there are inalienable rights that cannot be taken away from you, because they're not given to you by any government. They're given to you by God. They're given to you because of who you are, because you exist, right? You just are granted those. And that's kind of what I think Odo is getting at here, which is such an interesting and like fascinating thing for us to be getting with this character. And it tells us a lot about who he is as a person and what he's willing to do and what he's willing to stand for that go beyond any government, which is why he could work for the Cardassians. And now work for the Bajorans, because people saw him as being that person who upheld justice and not just a law that people, you know, were passed down by some bureaucrats on some planet somewhere.
Which implies that, again, watching through, we don't know anything at this point, implies that when he worked for the Cardassians, he did not simply blindly uphold what Gold Dukat or what the Cardassian government wanted. Sort of an outside voice, had an outside view on that. And yeah, in terms 100%. Of, you know, the rights, you know, from my perspective, not being religious myself, you said, though, that we have them because we exist, which I agree with. Like, that's the fact that we exist, that we are individuals, we have rights that shouldn't be determined necessarily by a governmental body. And but also, just like there are things that might be legal, but it doesn't mean they're right, there are also things that are illegal that probably shouldn't be, because some group, a governmental body, has decided to oppress right. people, you know, which we see in societies around our world as well. So there mm-hmm. are, you know, two yeah. ways of, two sides of looking at that. And where Odo yeah. is, it's, yeah, it's interesting. And it's interesting to set this type of character up at the beginning of the show, because it really does allow them to have someone who, through whom they can explore differing views of not even really Federation and Bajoran or Federation Cardassian, mm-hmm. but they're able to actually question the
right.
foundational ideas of Star Trek in a way that you couldn't do on a show like yep. The Next Generation, because it just wasn't allowed, because, you know, this was Gene Roddenberry's view of the future and this is how the Federation was supposed to be. And of course, as a Starfleet officer, you're not going to openly right. question that, right? You've gone to the academy, you've been trained in it. But as viewers, I think especially as you get older and you have more life experience, as viewers, right. you do look at a lot of the things, even on The Next Generation, and question, like, okay, but I know the episode's telling me this is the right thing, but is it? Right? And you can't mm-hmm. really question that. But yep. here you can, because of the situation, but also having someone like Odo here who has no problem with pushing back against Sisko, it really opens things up for the writers.
I think what it comes down to is that, and we've mentioned this before on the show, but I think it's very much in line with what's happening in this episode, which is we're challenging the preconceptions of TNG mm-hmm. on the frontier. We're yeah. challenging utopia.
Mm-hmm.
And whether or not that actually works everywhere, right? Which is what makes this such an interesting show. And I think it's one of the things that made this so challenging for people in general as they were watching it, coming off of TNG, mm-hmm. which, you know, for 6 years had kind of indoctrinated them into, like, this is the way it is. Mm-hmm. And then DS9 comes in and it challenges those preconceptions, right? But in a way that then reinforces the best of what we love about Star mm-hmm. Trek,
yeah.
but then maybe also shows where it may or may not be right. And I think, you know, it's subverting expectations mm-hmm. in the absolute best way possible.
Yeah. It's interesting, like, for me, when I think about Star Trek and what it teaches you, why it's important, how it shaped me as I was growing up, the fact that it should open your eyes to be able to look at things that are different from you and see them from different perspectives and be accepting and be open-minded, and it doesn't mean you have to 100% agree, and you might look at another culture and completely disagree with something about it, but at least you can examine it, you can take in the information, you can think about it, and you can put yourself in someone else's shoes. And that's what Star Trek has always meant to me. But if you look at the voice of fandom and certain parts of fandom, you can see that that point is very much missed by a lot of people who, if you don't completely agree with the way they do something or the way they see something, then you're definitely on the wrong side of it. And so I think, like you're saying here with DS9, we are kind of, well, TNG sort of conveys that black and white message though, right? Where this is what
right.
should be right and this is what is wrong. And like you say, here we are challenging that in DS9. And another thing here with Sisko and the situation with Odo that also stood out to me in terms of, like, coming into a new situation and figuring out how to assess what's going on is the fact that he doesn't know Odo. And Odo actually calls him out on this in the episode when eventually Sisko tells Odo, "I don't personally think that you killed him." And Odo says, "How do you know? You don't know anything about me." Basically, you don't know what my motivations might be. So Odo calls him out on that. But earlier in the episode, when Zayra comes and talks to Sisko first and then talks to Kira, the three of them together, you know, Kira immediately says, there's no way Odo could have done this. That's crazy talk. But Sisko's not quite so sure. And I think that also is an element that I like in the writing, because they give us, they make it clear to us that we, in this case, through the eyes of Sisko, are being plopped into a story midstream. And there's this whole history with some of the people here that we don't know anything about. And Sisko doesn't know anything about it. And so Sisko has this outside perspective, kind of like I talked about Odo and Quark having at the beginning when they watched the O'Briens. Sisko's an outsider here too, trying to assess what's going on. And that is another interesting way of challenging, I think, the way that we think we know how things mm-hmm. should be or how they are when we don't.
Well, and I think that you saying that, it goes to show that Sisko is willing to give people the benefit of the doubt, but that doesn't mean that he's not willing to question mm-hmm. things, you know, and that he is, it's going to be a blind trust in people. He's willing to extend trust, but then you have to continue to build into that. And he, I think he trusts Odo to a point here, but at the same time, this is a place where Odo has to continue to earn it. And, you know, obviously by the end of the episode, what do we get? We get Odo being able to earn that trust by being proven innocent.
Mm-hmm. One other thing I wanted to just chat about a little bit in terms of the story itself is we know what DS9 turns into. Everyone knows it's famously this rather highly serialized take on Star Trek, certainly for its time. And it didn't start out that way. Although on rewatches, I think you and I agree that you can see a lot of the elements being plopped into each episode throughout season one mm-hmm. that they can build on. But in the beginning, Michael Piller had said about this episode in particular that they wanted to do A, B, C plots, so have three plots in a story, not just a A, B, which I think when we watch TV these days, that's not particularly unusual. I've mentioned before my favorite sitcom, News Radio, most episodes, this was in the mid-90s, even then had A, B, C mm-hmm. plots and sometimes had maybe an occasional D plot in a 30-minute show. But Michael Piller talked about Hill Street Blues and that he kind of saw DS9 and the station as being like Hill Street, and they could do like Hill Street Blues style storytelling on Deep Space Nine. And he wanted to have these multiple ABC plots going on and kind of weave them together. But importantly, he didn't want it to become like this serialized show. And yet that's what it turned into. And mm-hmm. in this episode, the plots are the Odo murder mystery would be the A plot. I'd say the B plot is Keiko and Miles and the struggles they're having with Keiko settling into the station and then Sisko helping her set up the school. And then the C is the, it's not a love triangle, but the triangle of interest in question with Benjamin, Sisko, and Bashir and Jadzia, where Bashir thinks that maybe Sisko is interested in Dax and seems to be a little bit jealous. And then they have a conversation together over lunch. But anyway, in terms of the, like, I called it a narrative hat trick, but what do you think about Michael Piller's concept here? And especially knowing that the show actually becomes the serialized television that maybe he was trying not to get caught up in at the beginning.
It's interesting to me that is his thought process here at the beginning. And I think what makes that difficult for Deep Space Nine, even in the first season, is the fact that this is a show that its exploration is of the universe by not moving. Mm-hmm. But by allowing the universe to come to it, and therefore the lives of our characters revolve around more of their day-to-day in a way than has ever been done. And so I think that's the thing that makes this so interesting. And I think I get, you know, I think Piller is trying to protect what he saw as this Star Trek formula as created by TOS and TNG. And yet, you know, in many ways, I think Deep Space Nine actually begins to mimic the TOS movies more mm-hmm. than anything else, where it becomes a more continuous story. You know, 2, 3, 4, and 6, and, you know, in some ways, even 5 a little bit, all play together as this, you know, big story where the characters and everybody's progressing from one place to another.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because, you know, you had Nick Meyer realize that the genius of Star Trek was the character relationships, not the fantastical adventures that they go on. Those only help build the relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that ends up being what the Deep Space Nine writers realize. What people want are these intricate relationships between the characters. And the more that they were given that, I think the more people began to gravitate towards the show. And I think it's the why Deep Space Nine, but every other Star Trek show, has had such a robust shelf life on DVD, and then of course with streaming, where people can binge, because you get sucked in and then you can't stop.
Right. Yeah. And one other thing just related to his comments about this episode, I wanted to mention, because we've been talking about this being the second episode produced, but the third aired. And apparently the reason for that is that he felt that this episode was soft and wasn't a sufficient transition from Emissary. I guess the past prologue was stronger to keep viewers hooked as they moved past the pilot. Do you agree with that?
I do think that, as we talked about it last week, that past prologue, I think, does a pretty good job of really following on some of the major thematic elements,
mm-hmm.
and therefore is probably stronger in that way. But I think this does a great job of actually following up on the thematic elements from the second week.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that it was a good choice, mm-hmm. Because I think it really does end up working. And so, which is, it shows you how interesting it is to write a show like this and how you can kind of reorder things. And if you're a good enough writer, you're not contradicting yourself in any way.
Mm-hmm.
So that speaks highly of what these people were already doing in the writer's room.
Right. So we've been talking about TNG comparisons a lot, and one really stands out to me that I wanted to get your thoughts on. For as much character development as we are getting packed into this episode, the mystery itself, it feels like something that would be right at home on The Next Generation. And as this story goes on, and when Julian makes the discovery of what's really happening and realizes that Ibadan is cloning himself, I could easily see Beverly figuring out the same type of mystery, just like Julian does. And so that aspect of the episode, to me, feels a lot like a Next Generation episode. What do you think that says about the series stepping out of the shadows of TNG and like finding its own voice here at the beginning?
Well, I mean, I think what it does show is that obviously Star Trek had become very formalized,
mm-hmm.
And had a formula to go off of. And it was a well-oiled machine at this point.
Yeah.
And so it was not difficult for them to be able to do this. But, you know, I think what is interesting, though, is that even though some of this show could have taken place on TNG, it's actually much more at home on Deep Space Nine, mm-hmm. because it actually is taking into account the relationships of the characters before we even got there, which is something that not quite seen on TNG,
right?
And much harder to do. And so I think that's one of the strengths of this, is that, yes, some of the elements you could have easily seen, you know, Dr. Crusher be a part of or something like that. But I think at the same time, they do a great job of creating something that actually works better on Deep Space Nine than any of the other shows that they have done.
Mm. And it would have been very difficult to have someone get murdered aboard the Enterprise and you not really know who might have done it because there aren't going to be a lot of unfamiliar people roaming around the ship. We hope.
Exactly.
You know, but you never know. You know?
Right. You know, unless it's Argyle just, you know, rattling around down there. You never know what's going on with that dude. So, that's a deep pull for Trek FM right there.
It is. And an even deeper one is that what happened is that Ibadan, he didn't pay his gin bill. And Argyle came out of the Jefferies tubes and went looking for him. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Rewind about 10 years on the Ready Room and you'll get that reference. But
That's how good we are in this show, Chris. So
we remember. Remember. I just put my hands right up to your face. Just like Spock.
Exactly.
Remember.
Just like it.
Okay, one more TNG connection as we get close to the end here. That happens midway through the episode. Keiko's school. You know, this resolution of what's going on with Miles and Keiko and trying to find something that Keiko can do and make her own aboard the station and find a place there on the station. She decides that she wants to open a school and she's very surprised that Sisko is completely open to the idea. Personally, I don't, maybe if I were in her shoes, I would be surprised because it's something I want to do and I'm asking for a bunch of equipment. But it seemed to me natural that Ben would be open to this and that he would want a school and a structure for Jake and he wants to build a community. Sisko wants to build a community on the station. And what better way to do that than to have a school and have somewhere for the kids to learn and bring the Bajoran children together with Federation children and Ferengi children and others. So it makes perfect sense. But this is where we first get the school. And I don't know, sometimes maybe I forget that this happens right at the very beginning of the first season. Of course, the school goes on until the third season. I think it's the House of Quark where the school gets shut down. So it runs, the classes run for a long time. A lot of crazy things happen. Vulcans eat homework, you know, all kinds of stuff goes on. But importantly, here in the first season, this is setting up a storyline that will be pivotal for the transformation, I think, of the tone and the voice of the show when we get to the end of the season.
Mm-hmm. Oh, 100%. And, you know, I think it's what's kind of beautiful about the situation is that, you know, Keiko has this problem and, you know, in many ways, Miles in classic male form is trying to solve her problem.
Yeah.
And Willie, she just wants somebody to listen. Mm-hmm. And by her just being observant, she's able to find a way in which she feels that she can be beneficial and feel needed in what she does, which is something I think, you know, I don't know who doesn't feel like that when it comes to their work. I mean, you want to feel like it's important, like it's needed, like you're doing something that's actually benefiting the world, right?
Right.
And, you know, Keiko, Miles feels that way. Everybody, one of the reasons people join Starfleet is because that's how they feel when they do that. And so Keiko wants the same thing. And what she finds here is the ability to be able to help by creating one of the most classic things that you have on the Western town, right?
Mm-hmm.
The school and the teacher, you know, and the importance then of that person being able to build a sense of community by bringing all the children together in one place and connecting them. And so, you know, I love this. I think it's great. And what's interesting is that, you know, Michael Piller might not have wanted there to be serialized storytelling, but this creates one of the very first points of serialization of the show, along with, and we talked about it earlier, the relationship between Bashir and idea. So it's so interesting, and I love that that's the case. I think it's really well done, and it's a lot of fun. I mean, the fact that she starts this school, and it starts off small, and you know, over the season, we just continue to watch it grow.
Yeah, I don't know if it's fair if we should say Michael Piller didn't want serialized storytelling in black and white terms, but in terms of this episode, you know, when he talked about the structure, but eventually, of course, the show evolves that way, and he's there with it.
Mm-hmm.
I think I said that later on Vulcans eat homework. Of course, I mean, they steal homework, but it would have been very amusing if they ate it. I would have liked to have seen that.
That's true. That's true. I mean, there's nothing worse than a Vulcan eating your homework. I mean, everybody knows that happens. It's kind of like, you know, when you have your Saylot eat your homework, maybe that's what you meant.
I think that happens on Vulcan quite often.
Yes,
for sure.
It happens a lot. Yeah, yes.
Yeah,
so,
yeah. But yeah, I love the fact that we have this school being set up, and it's a great way to start building Rom's character as well, because we finally get his name here. You know, he was just a Ferengi pit boss, I think, in Emissary.
Yep.
And he still isn't the Rom we know yet in this episode. You know, his mannerisms and the way he speaks and all, it's not Rom. He's a bit more generic Ferengi, but he is open to some ideas that other Ferengi wouldn't be. And so I think it's a nice start to the character. All right. Well, we've been going quite a long time here. So what are your final thoughts and what's your rating for this episode?
Mm-hmm. You know, I think that this is such a strong episode, and we've talked about this episode before, and we talked a lot about, I think, one of the strongest things, and we didn't go into, you know, real depth at all because we had really hit it home there. You know, this episode is one of those on Deep Space Nine, which is consistently relevant and more relevant than ever because of the way in which it deals with the mob mentality, and that these people, they think they know what the evidence is before all the evidence is in. They jump to a conclusion because of that lack of all the evidence and believing they know what happened and then demand what they consider to be justice.
Right. And then they jump on it because someone else jumped on it and someone else jumped on it. And it's like a snowball effect, right?
Yes.
And then facts don't matter anymore.
That doesn't sound familiar.
Right.
No, of course. It is sadly one of the most heart-wrenching things to watch this episode and realize that it is more poignant than ever.
Mm-hmm.
And so therefore, I think this is a ridiculously strong episode of the series. And it's brilliant in that way because of the way in which it deals with this topic. And it gives us some great character moments with, you know, Sisko, Jadzia, Bashir, Odo, Quark, a little bit of Kira. And so to me, I give this, I'm going to give this episode actually a good 4.5 out of 5 broken security windows.
All right. Well, we've got to get those repaired very quickly. Another task for the most important person in Starfleet history, Miles O'Brien. But yeah, that's
right.
That's all very well put. And yeah, that is, it does make this episode very poignant today, more so than when it aired, in my opinion. But yeah, I just agree. It's a really strong episode, and I think it's stronger than most fans remember, because when you think about this episode, you tend to remember, okay, Odo's accused of murder and it turns out he was framed, but there's all this other stuff that's going on in this episode which builds characters and builds the world of DS9 right at the beginning, that it's often subtle moments, you know, it's like a 30 second conversation over food. You know, it's stuff that you don't remember it as being part of this story in particular, but it's all there. And so for that reason, I'm going to give this episode 8 plates of fricasseed asna.
Nice. Fantastic.
All right, everyone. We would love to hear your thoughts on A Man Alone. There are many ways for you to share those with us. Perhaps the best way is to go to Facebook and join the Babel Conference. That is our listeners group. If you're already a member, you know what to do. But if not, and you're joining for the first time, it is a closed group. It's just for listeners. So please answer the questions and agree to the rules of the forum so that I can let you in. You can find it by typing Babel, B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, or the whole name, the Babel Conference. You can also send us email if you like. Go to our website, trek.fm/contact. Use the form you find there. Choose to send to a show and choose the orb, and that will come to Matthew and me by email. And of course, you can find us in social media. Our username everywhere is trekfm. Now, Matthew, when you're not, you know, practicing a game, trying to make everything a solid color, so maybe Jadzia will go out to dinner with you, where can people find you?
Well, you could find me all over the place under the name MattRushing02, so Twitter, Instagram, Letterboxd, Vero are the most active places for me. You can also find me here on the network. We've got a whole side of the network devoted to all of those other fandoms we love. It's called the 602 Club, so I hope you'll join us there. It's a lot of fun. Got some other shows as well devoted to Star Trek, Literary Treks about the books and the comics of Star Trek, and then we've got Warp 5. Chris, as you mentioned earlier, we're going through the 20th anniversary rewatch of that show. We've got Saddle Up. About Strange New Worlds, and I'm so excited that Star Trek Picard is just around the corner with Season 3, and we can't wait to dive into that on the Artificial Tango. Over on the Nerd Party, you'll catch me with two shows. One was completed. Already finished that. Drea Kaufman and I talked about every single chapter of the Harry Potter series, one chapter at a time. And then the great John Mills and I are talking about Star Wars each and every week over on Aggressive Negotiations. But Chris, you know, when you're not trying to figure out, you know, what you're going to do in the holosuite, whether it's the massage or, you know, something else, where are people going to find you?
Oh, man, when you started that, I was going to come back with, I'm going to be getting a massage on the holosuite. But you checked my calendar, just like Odo did in this episode. You checked my calendar. And I'll just say that once I get home aboard a shuttle from Alderaan Spaceport, which is a Star Wars reference on screen in this episode, you can find me talking about all the things on the podcast with you that you mentioned. And I'm looking forward to kicking off the Artificial Tango again, especially coming up here in just a couple of weeks when Picard Season 3 gets rolling. But you can also find me in many episodes of many shows in the back catalog. I've been doing this for more than 12 years now, so there's a lot of Star Trek talk there, so check that out. And if you'd like to chat with me in social media, my username everywhere is C. Brian Jones, letter C, and Brian with a Y. Twitter is where I'm most active, and I'd love to chat with you there. And if you would like to help us keep this rewatch and all the other stuff we're doing, all these podcasts going, we could definitely use your help. To find out how to help us, go to patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm. It takes a great deal of money to produce and distribute these podcasts and keep them all going. And we wouldn't be here without you. So a huge thank you to everyone who is supporting us now. Thank you so much. And if you're not, I hope you'll consider doing so. Again, patreon.com/trekfm. Well, Matthew, speaking of Babel, we mentioned the Babel Conference. I'm looking forward to talking with you next time about the episode called Babel here on the first season of DS9.
Well, Chris, I can't wait to get to that. And of course, thank you to everyone for joining us. And we will see you next time as we gaze into the orb.